Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Disciple Makers podcast by discipleship.org. This is your host, Dave Stovall. In this episode, Chris Harper from betterman.com emphasizes the need for a clear path and purpose in the journey towards spiritual maturity when discipling men. He outlines a multifaceted approach that includes the spirit of the word, spirit of the body, spirit of the mind, and the spirit of service. The ultimate goal is to guide men to become like Christ, serving as gifts to their communities rather than burdens. Here we go. This is Chris Harper from Better Man. Enjoy the episode.
All right, so we're going to talk about, in this last session, we're going to talk about a little bit what I shared on stage about a path that must be followed, but more so the changes that must happen when you disciple men. So the path was fairly simple. I'm not going to go deep into that because I talked about it on stage. You can talk about it if you got questions about it, but it's an invitation to journey from an older established man or community of men. It's a clear definition. The pathway has to be defined. This is the way we're going. There was a shift in the 90s regarding discipleship because of the structure of the church. The pendulum swung, and there was kind of like this belief that discipleship should be organic. Right? And here's what we learned from that. If you don't have a strategy, then it doesn't happen. It has to be something strategized for. It doesn't mean organic relationships and organic conversations and things of that nature can't crop up. Absolutely. You want that. You want spirit-led things. But if you're not strategizing, if you're not going in a direction with men, then you won't arrive at your destination. So something I do, super simple, but doesn't mean you have to do it, but it is a direction. So anytime I'm discipling a man, we're doing four or five things when we gather. We're talking about what I call the spirit of the word. So there's always Bible study involved. Okay, so we're always in scripture. So we're having spirit of the word. Next is spirit of the body, which simply means some sort of spiritual discipline. So whether that's prayer, whether that's fasting, whether that's one of the greatest disciplines that we don't hardly ever talk about in the church is the discipline of self-reflection, right? A.W. Tozer was big on that. So there's spirit of the body. So we got spirit of the word, spirit of the body. We're also talking about the spirit of the mind. So guys I disciple, I always have them reading. I'm a big reader. It's just a part of who I am. So we're typically, if we're going to be in a discipling relationship for a year, we'll typically read 3 to 4 books outside of the Bible. And I'm pretty careful in what books I'm recommending. Like, for example, I just finished a discipling group where we read through James K.A. Smith's, what was the name of that book? You Are What You Love. You Are What You Love. And about the desires of the heart. So good. So good. So spirit of the word, spirit of the body, spirit of the mind, and then spirit of service is the last thing. Women best relate and communicate face to face. Men best relate and communicate shoulder to shoulder. So there's always spirit of service. We're always, every 2 to 3 months, we're doing something for the kingdom together. Whether that's building a fence at a community center, whether it's going to serve somewhere, whether it's going to fix up a widow's house or something of that nature, I'm looking for things like that to do with the men I disciple and in a discipleship relationship. So spirit of the word, spirit of the body, spirit of the mind, a spirit of service. I try not to teach. I try not to preach. I try to let conversation happen. Again, most of what's designed today is for women. People have to understand that. Even this setup right here, it's set up for a woman. This is not how men best learn. It's just not the way our brains are wired, the different rods and cones in our eyes. So men and women have different numbers of rods and cones in their eyes. That's a minute like detail like that God ordained. Like one, because we have less rods, more cones, women are better at handwriting. which is typically why a lot of men have atrocious handwriting. Whereas men, because it's the opposite, we see things moving at a distance better, which is why in the day we were hunters and gatherers, because we could track a deer, right? Whereas women are not as equipped to do that. Like, again, minute detail. I'll tell you another one scientifically. A man's working on a fence, he's working in the garden, and he cuts his hand. Because of his body composition, his hand will heal faster on average than a woman's hand if she did the same thing. This is science, okay? The opposite, internally, a man catches a cold or a woman catches a cold, okay? I'm putting this off. She fights viruses and infections faster than a man does. Well, who do you think designed that? That's not by chance, right? And this is secular science, right? This is not even, we're not even in the Bible yet. So, well, we are because it's God's design, but paying attention to things like that, walking men through that path. The death of childhood thinking is huge, right? It's huge. We've got to show men that there's transitions in life, that at some point you have to put the childish things away, and then you have to step in into God's call and God's design. This is really hard for men today, especially younger men. One of the main reasons it's hard is because the marriage age, right? Men are getting married later and later in life. One of the most maturing points of a man's life, and I'm sure a lot of you could testify to this, is the point you bring on a bride, because you assume a level of responsibility. And then it gets even deeper when you bring in children. There is a natural maturing when you have a wife and when you have children. So if you wait to have children, if you wait to have a wife, there's a natural, what I would call like a spiritual retarding or a spiritual retardation that happens. Okay? And with that age getting further and further out, we're seeing men later and later to mature. Because I don't have to. I don't have a woman to provide for. I don't have children to provide for. So I can just live in the basement and play video games. You know, for the first time, we have more unemployed men under the age of 30 today than we've had in the history of our world. And it's not because there's not necessarily enough jobs, because they just don't have to work. Don't have anybody to provide for. And then the education gap has made it worse. So the whole Title IX and that whole movement in the 70s, and listen, like we needed to catch up. Like we were leaving women behind for sure. Educationally, pay gap, we were leaving women behind, but we swung the pendulum all the way over, and now men are being left behind. I mean, they're graduating with bachelor degrees 2-1. They're graduating with professional degrees 4-1 for the first time in the history of the world. Last year at all 20 Ivy League schools, the law review editor-in-chief was a woman at all 20 schools for the first time in history. Now, some people may say, well, great, it's about time women are getting advanced degrees and graduating college. Well, great, until you get into the South, where Harvard just did a study, I encourage you to read it, called Bubba's South, where women are excelling way beyond men, not so much so that they won't marry them. They won't marry them because they're not equally yoked. They see no value in it, especially when we can do artificial insemination and things like that. I don't even need a man now, technically, to have a child. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it. And this gap is growing, man. So we've got to help young men see that, listen, there's a point that you put to death childhood thinking, right? And then you step into God's good design, what Betterman calls the 4 W's, but I don't want to press that on you because you may have other things. I don't want to act like our tool is the only tool. Then there's this season of transformation that happens in the encouraging space. You know, we want to encourage men, not discourage them. And there's the recognition, there's a blessing by a community of men to take their place in the world. Okay, so I covered that a little bit. Here's the changes that must happen. During this process, there are five changes that must take place. First is a relational change. Men must learn to navigate and build relationships within the community of men. He must transition from a life defined by feminine empathy to masculine challenge. This is not to remove emotional connection, but it's to deeper and mature it. Okay? So again, secular science has proven there's a sociological term called too much mom. When a boy gets too much mom, one of two things will happen. He will either become codependent upon women, or he will grow to abuse women. And it doesn't just mean physical abuse. It can mean emotional, sexual, et cetera. Okay? So we have a generation the last 30, 40 years that have hand over fist gotten too much mom. Too much mom. And they are emotionally distraught. There is no emotional maturity. Their emotional IQ, there's been books written about this, is way lower than it should be. So when I'm discipling a young man, I am calling him to a relational change. I'm helping him rewire how he relates to women. I'm helping him rewire how he relates to other men. I'm helping him rewire how he relates to the world. There has to be this relational change, because he has, without knowing it, he has super high feminine empathy. He has feminine traits, feminine tendencies, right? There's not a lot of emotional stability. That's why we have 30 and 40 year old men acting like they're 6 years old when something doesn't go their way. Right? So we move in relational change. Secondly, there's a psychological change that comes with that. Most men today live in a deep, deep state of naivety. They have simplistic and selfish thinking. So the community of men works to mature, expand, and develop real life wisdom so that they can navigate the complexities of adult life. Most men today don't know how to function in adult life because they're just supremely selfish. Supremely selfish. And it's not necessarily a new thing. Augustine called it the incurvatus. What, incurvatus, it's the inward curve. It's we're born with this curve, like inward. And then all of Christian life is bending that curve outward. Right? Eugene Peterson said it's a life of congruency. Eugene Peterson said the hardest thing for a Christian man is to take what he believes and line it up with how he lives. And he just wants a congruent life. Right? Well, we do that through a psychological change, largely understanding that the world, science has proved that the universe is ever expanding. And if that's the case, you can't be at the center of it. And a lot of men need to hear that. Like, it is not about you. It's not about you. Your existence is here for others. Namely, your existence is here to glorify God. But you do that like Martin Luther said, God doesn't need your good works, but your neighbor does. So you put those works on display so people can bring glory to God. It literally is selfless living. And it's the New York Times columnist guy just wrote a book called Second Mountain. It's a secular book, but it's all about this. Most men get to the top of the first mountain and they think they've arrived, only to discover there was actually another mountain behind it. And that mountain behind it is selflessness. That's true identity. That's true purpose, is when you start to give yourself away. And I'm telling you, I just spoke to a football team recently, and they asked me, it's so funny. Everybody always wants one thing I can do immediately to get better. Okay. And my whole premise is discipling men is like wind carving stone. You seen the Grand Canyon? That took a little while, but it's magnificent. It's strong. It's beautiful. You look at it and you take a step back. You want to behold it. Well, men are the same way. Men become strong, beautiful. Like, you take a step back, you want to behold a man, but it's wind carving stone. But I was leaving this football team and they were like, give us one thing, give us one thing. I said, all right, here's what you can do. The football season is 4 months long. Let's assume it's 4 months long. Maybe you get to the playoffs and it's 5 months, 6 months long. I said, for the next 6 months, anytime you tweet, anytime you post, anytime you're on social media, I just want you to tweet or post about someone else on your team and nothing about you. Just do that. Just boost everyone around you and nothing about you. Not a single player took me up on the offer. One of the biggest psychological deficits today, especially amongst men, is this selfishness. It's inclination to selfishness. And what was natural because of the fall just has been expedited because of social media, because of many platforms. Could you imagine telling Peter or the Apostle Paul, hey, 2,000 years from now, there's going to be this thing where every day I'm just going to talk about myself on it. And I'm going to post pictures of what I eat. I'm going to shoot video from my workout. I'm going to, this new car I bought. And just every day I'm just going to talk about myself on it. They would think you're crazy. They would think, who would derive something like that? Well, it's called Facebook and Instagram and MySpace, which ain't a thing anymore. So that has to be a psychological change. We have to help men see, hey, this is not about you. It's about others. Relational, psychological, then there's a theological change. It's a theological change. Men must deeply examine their beliefs about God and their faith. He must learn, challenge, and wrestle with the convictions and beliefs. He must do this without fear or judgment, so he owns the faith. To become a priest, he must have a vision of the sacred that he can articulate and that he's responsible for. This is a little bit what we talked about yesterday. This man can't own your faith. He has to own his faith. All you are is the trellis, right? Some of my restoration brothers, I'm ordained in the restoration movement. Some of my restoration brothers, they say things like no creed but the Bible. And sometimes they get on to me because I'm a creed guy. And they're like, Chris, you don't need the creed. And I always explain it like this. The vine is growing upward. The trellis helps the vine grow in the right direction. We just want to be a trellis. If you're the vine, God's going to grow you. I'm not going to grow you. I get that. I mean, I'm theologically sound in that. But I'm going to be the trellis so you don't start growing way to the left. No, I want you to grow upwards to God. So when we talk about theological disposition and we talk about theological guidance, I'm not trying to tell you what to believe. I'm trying to guide you so you believe the right things. That's what I want to do. Because for you to be able to believe it, own it, and articulate it, it means it's in there, right? It's just not my thoughts. It's not my thoughts. Well, how do we do that? The number one way to do that is the Socratic method. We do it by asking questions, which, by the way, read the Gospels. Jesus asked far more questions than he did make statements. He would often say, well, what does this say? Or what do you think about this? Or why this? He was always asking questions. I do that all the time to young men. And the number one answer is, well, I don't know. I don't know why I believe that. Well, I know why you believe it, because it's the environment you grow up in, or it's what you're predisposed to, or it's what you are. You know, men don't know how to think for themselves. We want to develop thinkers. I'll never forget, I went to a small little school here in the South called Bellarmine. It's a small little Catholic private university. And I'll never forget, I was a straight A student, number one in my class. I come from a small town, so I was like a big fish in a small pond. I go to this kind of prestigious school and I become a small fish in a big pond. And I'll never forget, I took my first exam. I failed it. First thing I've ever failed in my life. I come to the professor and the professor says, hey, where are you from? I said, I'm from a little place called Bardstown, Kentucky. He said, oh, that explains a lot. He said, I'm going to let you retake the test. He said, but I'm going to teach you how to think. I said, well, it's my fault. I should have known the information better. He said, no. He said, I'm going to teach you how to think. I'm going to teach you how to learn. He said, that's different. And he invested in me. And he began to teach me how to think. He began to help me see that it's better to ask questions than it is to make statements. He was the first one that taught me the value of reading. And not just reading stuff I believe. And listen, man, I'm a man of deep convictions, like deep theological convictions. Like, it's hard to move me, right? And I'm not shy about them. I mean, you read my bio, I'm a credo, baptistic, Calvinistic. I'm charismatic with a seatbelt. Like, I lay it all out, right? I'm very convicted, but I've always kept an open mind, a mind that knows to be open and when to shut things out, right? I read, I love. Like, if you're conservative, I love reading liberal things. If you're liberal, I love reading conservative things. Like, I want to know how the other half is thinking and speaking and feeling, right? And it makes us well-rounded. Sometimes I think we get afraid of those things. Like, I had a group of men read Rob Bell's book, Love Wins, because I wanted them to be able to pick it apart. Tell me what's good about it. Tell me what's wrong about it. Tell me why that's wrong, right? And it's amazing. That was one of the books we read one time, and we went through that together. bro, theological enlightenment everywhere. Asking questions and answering questions they had never thought about, heaven and hell and things of that nature. I remember I had a professor, so I'm not charismatic with a seatbelt. I don't know where I stand today, but I used to be a cessationist. I used to believe the gifts have ceased. Again, I don't know where I'm at today. That's one of those things that there are some things you put in concrete and there's some things you put in wet sand. That's something I've got in wet sand right now. And I remember he made me read Jack Deere's book, Surprised by the Voice of God. Jack Deere is the real deal. He's a DTS theologian. Vineyard Church in Cincinnati, once DTS fired him. DTS fired him because Jack Deere claimed that students would come to his office and then the Lord would illuminate something above their head. And then he would tell them, hey, you're wrestling with pornography right now. And the student would be like, how do you know that? Or, hey, you're wrestling with this. How do you know that? Jack Deere claimed that the Lord showed him that. And that's how he counseled them. Well, at Dallas Theological Seminary, that don't fly. So Jack was fired. I had to read that book and then write a response, right? And I'll never forget when I was doing my doctoral work, I had asked one of the professors, I said, hey, have you read Jack Deere's book? Because he was a cessationist. And he said, yeah. I said, so what do you do with that? Did it happen or was he just lying? Because it's really one of the two. I'll never forget, he looked at me. He said, Chris, have you ever been to college? I said, yeah. He said, did you wrestle with pornography? I said, yeah. He said, sounds like a pretty good guess to me. And I thought, oh. I mean, so you know, it's interesting, right? And there are some of those things theologically that, you know, that it's okay to disagree on, right? Al Mohler, he was my Sunday school teacher for a while. And we went to the same church for a while. And he taught me something one time called theological triage. And he said, a triage doctor, if you come in with a broken arm and I come in with a heart attack, he knows to see me first because it's a first level issue. He said, there are first level issues that we cannot agree to disagree on. If you and I disagree and one of us are right or wrong, it's the difference between salvation. Like, we cannot agree to disagree. Like, we have to sit and we have to wrestle and we have to find out that answer. Okay. He said a second level issue is what we can disagree on, but we're probably not going to worship together. And that's okay. Right. So, for example, infant baptism. That's not my jam. Okay. But I'm about Presbyterian and everything else. I can't get behind infant baptism. But I don't look at R.C. Sproul, who is infinitely smarter than me, and think R.C. Sproul is an idiot. What I'm thinking is I'm looking at scriptures and I'm asking myself, what's R.C. Sproul see that I'm missing? Because he's infinitely smarter than me. Like, I'm searching for it. And I've been searching for infant baptism for 15 years now, and I still can't find it. Right? So what that means is R.C. Sproul and I can disagree. We're both going to go to heaven. We're just probably not going to worship at the same church on Sunday, and that's okay. It's okay. And then all these other third-level issues are issues we can disagree on, but still worship in the same place. And what the church loves to do, what Christians love to do, is take those third-level issues and make them second and first-level issues. Right? One of the biggest second-level issues you're going to face now in the next 30 years is going to be women elders and women teachers. It is the next big issue. And then following that will be homosexuality and things of that nature in the church. Those are massive issues. I would put the first one at a second level, and I would put the latter at a first level. And it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. It's super interesting. But we want to help guide, not give them, but help guide their theological convictions. That also means putting sound literature and materials in front of people. I don't let people, if I'm going to have them read garbage, it's because there's a point to reading that garbage and it's supervised. Otherwise, I put good theological materials in front of people, constantly sending people, read this article, this is a good article, or look at this opinion, etc. Then you're going to see a sociological change, right? A man must be pulled into a story larger than himself. He must realize the ancient story he is a part of. He must understand he's joining a great tradition. He must have a sense of being caught up in a deeper, older story, not stuck in the small story of his own making, which is where a lot of men are, right? We've been invited into this grand narrative of God's plan of redemption, right? So creation, fall, right? Redemption, consummation. I love what Ryken said. He said creation, fall, grace, glory. I think that's super simple, and I love that. I'm a super simple guy. Creation, fall, grace, glory. There's this gospel arc, right, that you're inviting people into. So you need to teach men what it means to be a man in creation, God's design for creation and manhood. You need to teach men about the fall. What was man's role in that? How does that affect us today? You need to teach men about grace. You need to teach men about glory. Where does the church major today? The church majors in grace, right? And then sometimes we'll get into glory. A lot of times we'll get into the fall. Rarely do we talk about creation, like in the purpose behind creation. Most people only get 20 to 30% of the gospel most of their life, right? We want to be men that give the whole arc from creation all the way to glory. We're showing men this amazing arc, right? This amazing story that they're a part of. And it has nothing to do with them, and it has everything to do with God. There is a massive me-centered theology that happens in the church today. Think about the phrase, Jesus died for your sins. Who's the hero in that story? It's not Jesus, it's you. Like most people, that's all they hear. They hear that half of it. What they never hear is also Jesus died because of your sin. Like it's your sin that was sending him there, right? That takes the onus off of you and puts it back on Jesus. Like it really is all about Jesus. It is not about you. And I can't tell you how many young men need to hear this. Yes, Jesus died for your sin, but he also died because of your sin. Yes, you're not saved by works, but you're also saved by his works. There's always this competing ideology, and we've got to show men the full breadth of the gospel. Paul said, I've preached the full gospel. There's no blood on my hands. It's the full gospel. Right? And we, as our church, and I'm really going to beat up on the church on this, the church has to get back to that. Has to get back to that. I pastored a church for some years, man, and we were all about grace. Grace, grace, grace. And I'm afraid, man. I'm afraid. The worst day in ministry for me, the worst day, we did the first church I pastored, this is crazy. The first church I pastored had 6,000 members. We did this mass on baptism Sunday. Grace, 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 grace. Massive baptism Sunday. We baptize a man and a woman, their boyfriend and girlfriend, and celebrate their story and have no idea the man's wife is sitting in the congregation. Worst day of my ministerial career. Telling you, man, we've got to be careful. We got to be careful with what we're doing. And I mean, I still reel from that. I still reel from that email, from that phone call. Right, we can't play loose and fast with this. There has to be the full story. I just spoke to 1,000 college students last week, and it was not what they were expecting at all. It was not your typical college rah 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 go and change the world. Like it was not that. What it was, hey, most of you've grown up in an area of something called easy believism, where you were asked to raise a hand or walk forward or sign a card, and there was no renewal, what the Bible calls the rebirth or regeneration. And I'm not here to judge you, but like, were you born again? Do you have a genuine affection for Jesus? Right? I think R.C. Sproul was right. He used to do the three-legged stool. He would say you have to have three things to be a believer. You'd have to have gnosia, which is the knowledge of who Jesus is. You would have to have essentia, which is agreement and assent he is who he is, but then you would have to have fiducia. You would have to trust he is who he is. And he would throw himself down in the chair and say, this chair can hold a 230-pound man, right? And then he would always give that example. So you had to have those three things. As you all know, R.C. Sproul recently died about 5 years ago. So John Piper went to speak at his funeral, and John Piper told a phenomenal story at his funeral. I'll never forget it. Piper said in 1992, R.C. Sproul called him and asked him to come speak at the Ligonier Conference, which is a big deal. If you're a preacher, the preachers of preachers get to speak at Ligonier. And R.C. Sproul said, John, we want to have you. Not only do we want to have you, we want you to end it. We want you to be the main attraction at the end. So that morning, R.C. Sproul was a keynote, and he did his stool presentation, the notia and the essentia and the fiducia, and he did it, and that's what you got to have a real faith. And John Piper takes the pulpit later that afternoon, and he's telling himself inside, R.C. Sproul's wrong. He's, I've got to say it. So he goes through this sermon, and at the end, he said, hey, I don't think R.C. Sproul's right. Yeah, I think you got to have the notion, the knowledge. Yeah, you got to have the ascension and agree. Yeah, you got to trust it. But he goes, but you got to love the chair. You got to love him more than anything else. And he said he shut his Bible and ran backstage before R.C. Sproul could get to him. And as he was going out the door, he said he felt this massive arm. R.C. Sproul was a big man. Grab his arm. And Piper turned around, and there was R.C. Sproul. And he said, John, I want you to know, I love the chair. I love it. There's a book written in the 1970s called A Roadside Picnic. Not a great book. It was written by a Russian philosopher. It was written in apocalyptic town. But it's interesting. In the middle of the town is a place called The Room. And if you could get to the room would give you your heart's desire. So these three men set off to the room to get their heart's desire. And on their way to the room, they see a man coming back from the room who's rich, powerful, and wealthy. Later in the book, you discover that he set out with his twin brother to go to the room. His twin brother died along the way. So the man told himself, if I can just get to the room, I can get my brother back. If I can just get to the room, I can get my brother back. If I can just get to the room, I can have my brother back. But the room gives you what your heart truly desires, not what you say you desire. And when he got to the room, what he truly wanted to be was rich, powerful, and wealthy. And that's exactly what he got. He hangs himself at the end of the book because of the guilt and shame that he wanted wealth more than he wanted his brother back. Much like the room, Jesus, God, reads the heart. He knows what we want. Only he knows what we desire. The first would-be disciples that come to Jesus, right there, John chapter 1, they come across a lake and they say, Rabbi, and Jesus turns and he says, what do you want? It's the first thing Jesus ever speaks to a would-be disciple. The Greek translation there is, what do you desire? It's the first question he's asked, and it's the question he's asked everybody ever since then. Every one of you, every man, your disciple, Jesus is asking you, what do you want? What do you desire? Because if it's not me, then you missed it. And I don't share that desire with anything else or anyone else. You can't have two masters. It is me and only me. And again, that's that piece we don't talk about a lot. Right? And if you were to ask me right now, well, Chris, how can you even know if you're saved? I believe you can. I believe the Bible says you can. If you were to ask me right now how I know I'm saved, I'll tell you two reasons. It's because I love King Jesus. And I'm fighting sin. I want to be holy. And I want to be like him. Ask me tomorrow, and if I tell you no to one of those two things, then I'll have reason to worry. But right now, I love Jesus. And I'm willing to fight sin. That's how I know. He's given me that. He's given me his spirit. And I think we've got to call men to that. There's this ideology today that you can get Jesus and then live. And I'm not saying this for effect, but you can live however the hell you want to live. That's exactly what you're living for. You're living for hell. That's not the case at all. Now, it doesn't mean, I believe Tozer was right. I believe that just like more people are gifted with faith and things of that nature, There's also people that grow in holiness at different speeds. I've got a friend who I'm convinced is a believer, but he cannot get out of his own way. I'm constantly praying for him. And he is like just a spiritual babe, just like on the teat of the church, man. And he will not get off of that thing. And I'm trying to encourage him. I'm trying to build him up. He genuinely loves Jesus. He cannot get out of his own way. There is such thing, this is Tozer's words, there is such thing as spiritual retardation. I don't think there's carnal Christianity, but I do think people are slower than others. That's okay. As men, we exercise patience and we bring them along. But at the same time, when we're discipling a brother who is growing at a great clip or a great speed, man, we want to encourage that. We want to foster that. Christianity is not like our public school system, which is built on socialism. Everybody gets the same thing. No, it's different. We recognize this brother's growing, this brother's slower, this brother's at a good pace, and then we're feeding them accordingly. This is why I always tell new believers, especially, I have a new believer come to me and they say, I'm going to read the Bible in a year. Bro, no, you're not. It's why Genesis 1 through 12 are the most read chapters in the history of the world. You get to chapter 12 and you're out. Starts getting complicated, starts getting weird. Yeah, I'm out. No. Have you ever read the Bible before? No. Do you read the Bible now? Not really. Okay, how about we start with 5 minutes a day? Let's just do that. 5 minutes a day. Let's go to the Gospel of John. I want you to read 5 minutes a day. We're going to talk about it on Friday. And then after 3 months of that, hey, let's read 10 minutes a day. And then after 3 months of that, hey, let's read 15 minutes a day. I always remind people in Psalms, it says, blessed are the steps of the righteous, not the leaps and bounds. It's the steps of the righteous that God blesses. That's one of the things about men in discipleship. We throw men into the deep end of discipleship. They've never been discipled, and we wonder why they wash out after a week. No, man, let them wade in the shallow end. There's nothing wrong with that. Let them wade. Let them get a little wet, and then just walk them slowly deeper and deeper. I know it takes more time, and I know you don't get to show the badge of your fruit, but it's okay. Discipling men is like wind carving stone. It's wind carving stone. Now, I will tell you, the earlier we can get them, the easier it does get, typically, but it's like wind carving stone. Then there's a physical change. A man must learn to do with his physical strength. A man must learn what to do with his physical strength and sexual desires. It needs to be channeled and directed in life-giving ways. If his strength and sexuality are not held together, they will dissipate into violence, porn, and passivity. Most men today do not know what to do with their physical strength because the world has told them work smarter, not harder. We literally don't know what to do with our strength. We used to think our strength was used to protect and defend people, but President Obama, and again, I'm apolitical, so this is not a shot at anybody, he eliminated that when he opened up the military and all branches of service to women. And for the first time, we're one of the only industrialized countries in the world that send women to the front line. So you had a bunch of military guys thinking, infantry guys thinking, I thought it was my duty to. Then all of a sudden, President Obama coined the term women warriors. And listen, if you've got a wife that serves or anything like that, I'm not bashing on them. I'm just telling you, there was a psychological change. There's only one branch in the military now that women cannot serve in, and that's the armor division because of physical reasons, something called a menstrual cycle. Women can't be in a tank for long periods of time. So it's the only branch right now where women can't be tankers. Again, God's design, right? But now we've got women on the front line. We've got women doing this. You know, I tried to lift a suitcase for a woman on the airplane not too long ago, and she looked at me with disgust. I mean, it was everything she could to get the thing up. And I was like, hey, just let me help you. No, I have it. Well, it looks like it has you. I didn't say that. But it's like, we don't even know what to do with our strength. So when we don't know how to handle that strength and channel that strength, same thing with our sexuality. For the first time in the history of the world, there are more men and women cohabitating than married. Think about that. And all the data on cohabitation, it doesn't end well typically for your marriage. And I tell people all the time, I have tattoos. I have a lot of them. Cohabitation is like a fake tattoo. Fake tattoos are not cool. Why? Because fake tattoos give the appearance of permanence without the commitment. Did you catch that? That's what cohabitation is. It's the appearance of permanence without the commitment. It's not cool. For the first time in the history of the world, we have more young men cohabitating than we have married. It's a problem. It's a problem, the number of churches. I got to be careful because this is being recorded. Someone very close to me who's in a very high position at a church, you know, he came to me for advice. He said, hey, I'm paying my son. His son was in college. I'm paying for his rent, but he has a live-in girlfriend. He said, Chris, should I stop paying for his rent? He said, it goes against everything I believe. And I said, well, and before I could answer, he said, but they're not sleeping together. They sleep in separate rooms. So I started laughing. I said, I thought he was joking. He was trying to be serious. I said, bro, you don't believe that, right? There's only one thing in this world that's ever been undefeated. And that's it. Sex is undefeated. I said, you don't believe that, do you? He's like, well, I guess I don't. I said, well, okay. I said, well, I don't know. Do you think you're aiding and abiding in that? I mean, do you think you're permitting that? He said, I really feel like I do. I said, well, as Luther said, man, it's neither good to go against the word of God or your conscience. So if your conscience is telling you, it's probably a good sign. I wouldn't participate in that. But it's because we don't know. We don't know positive channels for our strength. We don't have positive channels for our sex. So it runs into things like pornography, violence, passivity, right? I forgot who said this. Maybe it was Augustine that said this. So Augustine believed that men were built for joy, built for worship, built for joy in the Lord. So he said that anytime we don't find joy and satisfaction in the world, in the Lord, we will turn to joy and satisfaction in carnal pleasures. I believe that. Okay, I'm going to say that again. Anytime we're not finding joy and satisfaction in the Lord, we will naturally turn to the world, turn to carnal pleasures for joy and satisfaction. I believe that's true. If that's true, the young man right now sitting in a basement watching pornography, he's not there because he's addicted. He's there because he's sad. That's why he's there. As C.S. Lewis would say, it's not that his desires are too weak, or too strong. It's that they're too weak. He doesn't desire something greater. He settled for mud pies on the seashore when God's offered him a holiday at sea. And here's the deal. Most of the men you disciple, listen, guys, there is a really, really strong chance I'm not going to leave here and you discover a week from now that like I run a prostitution ring. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to leave here today and all of a sudden you're going to be flipping through CNN and then I've robbed a bank, the world's largest bank, and you're like, oh, that was that guy. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen for the most men in this room. It's not going to happen for the most men you disciple. What's going to happen, though, is Satan will offer a man a shortcut to something God's already promised him, and we take the shortcut. And shortcut after shortcut after shortcut after shortcut, at the end of the day, we've literally given away our inheritance. And you say, well, Chris, where's scriptural evidence for that? Which is what you should always ask. It's Jesus in the wilderness. Think about the three things Satan tempted Jesus with. The fast was over. It wasn't wrong for him to turn rocks into bread. It wasn't wrong for him to throw himself off. Satan tempted Jesus with the three things God had already promised him. The only difference was Satan offered him a shortcut. And Jesus said no. Jesus was the king of enduring. He was the king of perseverance. Our problem is we haven't been taught endurance. We haven't been taught perseverance. So what we do is a little shortcut comes along and we take it. And then another shortcut, and then another shortcut, and then another shortcut. So instead of waiting to get married and to have sex and enjoy the good gift of that, we have a wait list now for AI girlfriends, which is the next big thing. One of them has a 1,500-man wait list right now. An AI girlfriend. You build her to your design. You tell her your disposition, and she will love you. She'll send you text in the middle of the day. Hey, I know you had a meeting today. I bet you crushed it. Keep your head up. Can't wait to see you later tonight. Hey, I know you're struggling with your mom right now. I want you to know that I love you. It'll cater everything right to you. Interesting. Super interesting. Little shortcuts to everything God's given us. And we men love a shortcut. You're going to have to train the young men you disciple away from shortcuts and let them know that the Christian life is an uphill climb and we cannot bring a downhill effort. We can't. It's an uphill climb. What will happen? What's the goal of these changes? The goal is that a new man will emerge at the end of this journey. He will be reassembled on the other side of the journey as a gift, not a burden to community. Today, men are a burden to community. We're going to deliver men as gifts to community. The end goal of discipleship is Christ-likeness. That's the end goal. But in that, the man no longer sees himself as a drain on the world, but like Christ, he is a gift to the world and he betters those around him. That's where we want to take men. We want to train men up so that those around them become better, become safer, become more like Christ. That's the end result. It is not, I wish I could stand before you and tell you some magic bullet, some, man, this is how you do it. It's going to be super simple. Run this play over and over again. But it's not. It's messy. And it is highly intentional. But you can strategize for it. You can. So as an older man or a community of older men, find that younger man. And it doesn't mean if you're 30, they have to be 20. You can be 30 and they can be 29. You can be 30 in 3 months and they can be 30 in 2 months. You just have to be one little step ahead. That's it. And that's not to say you can't lead up. I've seen men lead up well. I've seen a 28-year-old disciple a 33-year-old. Right now, I'm 41 and I'm discipling a 52-year-old whose life is an absolute train wreck. So you can lead up. That's not impossible, right? But typically the way we see it in the Bible, the way it works in the world, is you're going to find that younger guy and you're going to say, come along, come with me. You're going to define the path. This is where we're going. Whether it's life of the Word, life of the Spirit, life of service, life of the mind, whatever path you choose, whether it's better man is a 30-week journey. Literally on a church calendar, it's a 2-year cycle. You can disciple a group of men for 2 years through better man. Again, not pushing it, but I'm not selling anything because we give it away. So that's a path, but you've got to define the path. This is where we're going, right? You've got to encourage or stop thinking like a child. Put the video games away. Stop posting on Twitter so much. Like, we're going to put childish things away. When I became a man, I acted like a man. This is what this looks like. Hey, listen, I'm not the manliest guy, right? So one of the things I do, this has helped me immensely. I've started carrying a pocket knife with me everywhere I go. It's amazing. It's amazing how many people need a pocket knife in a day. I'm from Texas. You got to be careful drawing things, bro. That's right. So, I believe it. So it's amazing throughout the course of a day how many people will say, I need a knife. True story. I had my daughter and her best friend in the back of my truck. I was driving somewhere and they were trying to open a box. And she goes, hey, Scarlett, does your daddy have a knife? We need to get this open. And my daughter goes, yeah, my daddy always carries a knife. I wanted to pull over and cry. I was so happy. I couldn't wait, baby. I got you. I'm getting it out. I could not wait because I'm not a handy guy. Like, I don't know how to build things and things. So I just started carrying a pocket knife. So I give men I disciple a pocket knife now. Give a 23-year-old a pocket knife. It's amazing what happens. Because some of you had dads and granddads that did that for you when you were 12 years old, when you were 8 years old, and you still remember that. So do that, man. That's super simple. Get their initials on it. Pay the extra $4. Get their initials on it, man. So you're going to invite them into that, put away childhood things, and maybe here's a knife. We're not acting like a child anymore. Here's a knife. Got your initials on it. You're a man. Here. Right? And then you have that season of training, and then you have that commissioning, and then you start it again. Anybody I disciple, they have to commit to me to do it for three other people. So if I've discipled 100 men in the last 15 years, what it really means is I've discipled 300, 900, 2,700. You see where that goes, right? And I cannot wait. I cannot wait to get to heaven and somebody come up to me and say, "Do you remember Dave?" I'm going to say, "I have no idea who Dave is." "But you knew Michael." "Nope." "But Steve?" "Nah." "What about Nathan?" "Nope." "What about Carlos?" "Ah, I remember Carlos." I cannot wait for that to happen. Right. And I want that for you.
Thanks so much for listening to the episode. If you like what you're hearing from Chris and you want to hear more, join us at the National Disciple Making Forum. You just got a few days left to get tickets because the event is next week, May 1st. Go to discipleship.org and buy those tickets right now. Hey, if you are on the internet, that's a weird thing to say, everybody is, follow us on social media. Discipleship.org is on Facebook, Instagram, and on X. We'd love for you to follow our pages for exclusive content and articles. Thanks so much for being a listener of this podcast, and I hope that you enjoy the rest of your day. We'll see you.